Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll find out about Back to the Future celebrations with Sarah Everett. Mary Lou Spartz and Kathy Ruddy will be here to talk about the ceremony on Friday at Evergreen Cemetery, honoring those who lost their lives on the Princess Sophia in 1918. We'll hear about a career and networking panel with UAS Alumni Relations Manager Jesse Post. And we'll learn about the Lights On After School event. Those interviews, National Native News Writers Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon, currently 46 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The federal government has fined one of the country's largest energy producers for more than $2.1 million for underreporting oil and natural gas production on Native American leases. KGOU's Brian Hardzinski reports.
In 2011, the U.S. Department of the Interior's Office of Natural Resources Revenue issued Chesapeake Energy an order to restructure its accounting practices to correct unreported and misreported volumes on land leased by Native American individuals and tribes. The Oklahoma City-based energy giant said it fixed the problem by 2012, but the federal government found more uncorrected volume shortages in 2013. The federal agency handed out more than $13 billion to states, tribes, and individual Native American mineral owners in fiscal year 2014. For National Native News, I'm Brian Hardzinski in Norman, Oklahoma.
Some members of the Osage Nation in Oklahoma are fighting a proposed wind turbine farm. Some residents want an existing set of towers taken down. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio was recently in the area and has this report.
In the rolling hills and tall grass prairie of north-central Oklahoma near the city of Pawhuska, a private company has put up dozens of wind turbines after reaching agreements with some landowners in the Osage Nation. But there's still a court case over the project. There's also a legal battle aimed at stopping a second wind farm that would include several dozen more towers. Joe Connor of the group Preserve the Osage says historically his tribe has been forced off other lands around the U.S., and he sees wind farms as another major threat.
We believe that we're encountering another dislocation as industrial wind electric generating plants threaten to destroy our homeland.
Another tribal member, Patty McHenry, says she'd even like the wind industry to take the unusual step of removing the existing wind farm. McHenry grew up near the site and says as a child, she often thought of the area's history.
I had daydreams of dinosaurs romping through there. Then I had, as I grew older, well, those are buffalo runs. And now you look through there as you're driving. It's a distraction. You can't even drive at night.
But the wind industry seems determined to continue both projects in Osage County. Jeffrey Clark of the Wind Coalition of Oklahoma says it's a matter of property rights.
The issue centers around, ultimately, should a private property owner be allowed to develop his land?
Even Clark says when at least one of the major landowners is not an Osage tribal member. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
The Assembly of First Nations National Chief Perry Bellegarde says he's looking forward to working with newly elected Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on First Nations issues. Bellegarde says Trudeau's platform includes a commitment to education, missing and murdered Indigenous women, and a new nation-to-nation relationship. The National Chief is expected to meet with Trudeau on an action plan. Bellegarde thanked First Nations people for taking part in the election. The AFN, Canada's largest First Nations organization, urged people to get out and vote. Trudeau, the Liberal Party candidate, claimed victory Monday, ending a decade of Conservative leadership under Stephen Harper. Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in San Diego, California this week for the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention. The agenda includes addresses from state and federal officials and a focus on national priorities. NCAI Executive Director Jacqueline Peta says they're also looking at how to make change on the local level.
How can tribal leaders lead change at home? What does that take to be able to really make sure that policy changes really happen from the ground up? And those recommendations come there. So we'll be having some conversations around that and some of those critical pieces related to that.
It's an election year for president of NCAI. Current President Brian Clattesby is among candidates vying for votes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by WanderingBold.com, providing American Indian crafts and supplies since 1969. Shipping nationwide, virtually everything you need to powwow is at WanderingBold.com. Holiday delivery on orders placed by December 15th.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. It's about 6 minutes after the hour, currently 46 degrees at the Juneau Airport, 43 out in Gustavus, 46 over in Hoonah. It's warm here in the KTOO studios. I've just been joined by Sarah Everett. She's an actor, producer, and Back to the Future enthusiast. Welcome to the show, Sarah Everett.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. So this is a very auspicious week for things Back to the Future. Tell us about it.
Yes, very much so. Those of you who are familiar with the Back to the Future 30th anniversary, it is indeed the 30th anniversary of the first film that came out in 1985 with Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd. And it is also tomorrow the number one day in the entire timeline, space-time continuum, that is October 21st, 2015, the date that Doc Brown and Marty McFly arrive in the future 30 years ahead from 1985 in the second film in part two. And it's the 25th anniversary of the third film of the trilogy. So every Back to the Future fan this year, 2015, the entire year has just been a buzz for the franchise.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the first movie predates you.
Yes, it does. But I am as old as the second film, 1989. I was born when the second film came out, which is cool because that's the big film we're celebrating this year.
And what drew you to Back to the Future?
Christopher Lloyd. As an actor, I've always been inspired by his work ever since I was really, really little, with Angels in the Outfield, The Pagemaster, and, of course, Back to the Future. So as an actor myself, I've always related to Christopher Lloyd the most, with big brown eyes and eccentric characters and expressions. So he is my greatest hero.
All right. Well, tell us how you're going to be celebrating Back to the Future.
So back in May, I contacted the Goldtown Theater and said, hey, Back to the Future Day is October 21st, 2015. I would love to see if we can have a marathon of celebrating the Back to the Future trilogy at the theater. And after some work contacting Universal Studios with Colette Costa, who's been absolutely great, we have gotten all three films to be viewed at the Goldtown Theater starting tomorrow at around 4:30 p.m., but it airs at 5. We're playing the first film, and then right following that, we're playing part two. And then this upcoming Saturday, October 24th, we're having a whole day marathon of all three Back to the Futures back to back to back, we like to say. So it's a lot of fun.
And you've been working on social media for this event for a while, right?
I have, yeah. The last 2 years, I have become an admin and quite a huge member of the Back to the Future franchise community on Facebook, primarily. I'm a leader on just about every Back to the Future group, and this is a two-year project. We've been building up pictures and videos, all kinds of things, very active in the community, and it's been an explosion this past week, I will tell you, in this last couple of days, of how excited people from all over the world are for Back to the Future.
What would you say inspires all these folks to like Back to the Future so much?
It's a film that keeps giving, Christopher Lloyd said. He says that he's amazed after 30 years that the generations have continued to pick it up. Kids who saw it when they were young, you know, before I was born, they saw it, and then they showed their kids, and now they're growing up, and, you know, so it continues to grow and inspire audiences. It's got romance, adventure, action, action. It's got everything. That's why I'm so excited right now. It's like it's a film trilogy that is really among the best trilogies out there. And a lot of them from the 80s are, you'll find. So it's very exciting for a lot of people who have been who have grown up with it for the past 30 years.
Now, you may have already mentioned this. Sorry if you did, but we get to meet Doc Brown and Marty McFly at some of these performances, right?
That is right. You will meet Dr. Emmett Brown and Marty McFly tomorrow at the Goldtown Theater. They will arrive and be able to interact and take photos with people just before, between, and after each film viewing at the Goldtown Theater again. And that'll be tomorrow, and as well as all day Saturday. And then on the little performances, we're also having Monday night, Tuesday night, and Wednesday night of next week at the Goldtown Theater as well, when we play part one on one day, then part two, and then part three consecutively.
And who will be playing Doc Brown and Marty McFly?
Well, I didn't want to give that away, but that would be me. I am guilty as charged, since I, you know, Christopher Lloyd is my greatest inspiration as an actor. I can pick up his mannerisms. I will be Dr. Emmett Brown at the event, and my young brother, Samuel, is my Marty McFly. And our costumes are completely authentic. So it's going to be a lot of fun to get pictures and interact with people in character.
Sounds like fun. Give us the details and dates again, please.
So again, tomorrow is Back to the Future Day, October 21st, 2015. If you get to the Goldtown Theater at 4:30, you will be able to interact with Marty and I for trivia, for raffles. And the film starts at 5, and then the second film starts at 7. And then we are going to have a marathon of the entire trilogy on Saturday, this upcoming Saturday. Get there at noon. It'll go literally back to back to back, all three films, all day. I don't think we get out until like 9 p.m. or something that day. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Please come, bring your kids. There's going to be candy, raffle, trivia, prizes, lots of fun stuff.
All right. And where can they, what's the Facebook page called?
Oh, there's lots of them. You can go to backtothefuture.com. Just type in Back to the Future. My big page is called Back to the Future Forever. You'll see my name right up on that. So please join us as we celebrate Back to the Future Day.
Sarah Everett, a.k.a. Doc Brown, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
This sucker's electrical, but I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott! What? What the hell is a gigawatt?
How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts! Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
Look, all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium is available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Whoa, Doc, stuck here? I can't be stuck here. I got a wife in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
She's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what she wrote here, Doc. I mean, that says it all. Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, it just might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
This is Bird Note. Migrating waterfowl rest in a plunge pool in the Grand Coulee of eastern Washington State at the base of a massive dry waterfall, five times wider than Niagara Falls. The pool lies amidst a landscape like no other in the world. Here you find 100-ton boulders scattered across the land, gorges 1,000 feet deep, and enormous potholes. The origin of these channeled scablands, until recently, remained a mystery. But persistent geologists and photographs from Earth-observing satellites revealed their secret. During the last ice age, a lobe of the ice sheet covering western Canada dammed the Clark Fork River, creating a vast lake in what is now northwestern Montana. Several times during the past 15,000 years, the ice dam broke, sending hundreds of cubic miles of water roaring across the inland northwest and down the Columbia River Gorge. At bottlenecks in the gorge, floodwaters piled up 1,000 feet high, and some rivers briefly flowed uphill. Now, on this quiet, sunny October day, pintails and gadwalls bathe and preen in a pool created by one of the greatest floods the Earth has ever known. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. It's about 15 minutes after the hour, and I've been joined in the studio by organizers Mary Lou Spartz and Kathy Ruddy, and we're here to talk about the Princess Sophia and the memorial service that's coming up this Friday. Welcome to the show, Mary Lou and Kathy.
Thank you,
Scott.
Yeah. So, 1918.
Yes.
Is when that disaster happened.
Yes, it is.
Wow, so we're coming up on 100 years.
This is the 97th year,
yeah.
Yes. So we will have two more years to before the commemorative date, yes.
Okay, so you're going to be doing a memorial this Friday. Can you tell us what that's going to look like?
Well, it's a very simple one. We've been doing this for over 20 years. We gather, those of us who wish to, gather at the... at the grave of Walter Harper and his wife, Frances Wells, at Evergreen Cemetery. And this couple were on their honeymoon trip. They'd come down from Fort Yukon to catch the Princess Sophia out of Skagway, and they were headed south and going to visit her folks in Pennsylvania. And they were aboard the ship, and they died together. And the decision was made, because he was from Nenana and she was from Pennsylvania, that the family decided that since they died together, they should be buried together here instead of separating them in death. This is very romantic.
Yeah. Mary Lou, what has drawn you to that couple or the story of the Princess Sophia?
Well, obsession is obsession, you know. So it's a very interesting story, and it has many facets, and it's the story of a ship that was Canadian Pacific, and a freighter and a passenger ship, among others. There were many that plied the water here, and the Sophia was the last ship out of Skagway before the holidays started for both Canada and the U.S. So if anybody wanted to, you know, get to the Midwest by Thanksgiving, they needed to get on that ship. And many people were leaving Dawson at that time in the Yukon Territory to go to families for the winter, and they did that regularly. But many of them were leaving for good. Dawson was on the decline at that time.
And at 350 people dying, almost 350 people drowning, it counts as the worst maritime disaster in Alaska's history. And it was overshadowed because World War I ended just a week or so later. So a lot of the knowledge about the Princess Sophia sinking on Vanderbilt Reef has sort of been hidden. So I'm pleased to be part of this almost 100-year memorial Friday at noon at Evergreen Cemetery.
And in case some of our listeners don't know the details of the accident, please let them know, because it wasn't just a boat sinking. It was a sort of three-day event.
It was the Sophia was grounded. She left Skagway on November 23rd. She got out of there late, and it was snowing like it does. And it was just this horrific snowstorm that was pushing her off off course. And she was about a mile and a half off course when she hit Vanderbilt Reef, which is Eldred Rock. And she was stuck there. She just went up on the reef and was just jammed into there. The way the wind was blowing, she was sitting upright, just as if she'd been put there by a great hand. And you've seen perhaps photos of it. It looks very strange. Here's this ship on this rock. And that was because of the way the wind was blowing. It was supported that. But the captain, Captain Locke, assumed that after carefully checking, he sent a diver over the side to check the hull, and realizing there was no damage that could be serious damage to the hull, he decided, he notified his people in Vancouver, and they said, "We're sending the Princess Alice to take the passengers off. You understand, if you allow passengers to leave the ship, then your ship may be up for salvage." And they didn't want that to happen, nor did they want their passengers to have to be taken off by any but their own ship. So that was the arrangement. And on the morning of the 24th, a group of small ships went out to see if they could help the Sophia. And the captain refused help. And let me just read from my friend Sheila Nickerson's poem on why the quilt maker became a dragon, her section where she just talks about this. This is, let me read it from here. She foundered, the Sophia, for 2 days while Captain Locke refused aid. A sister ship, Princess Alice, was on her way from Vancouver. There was no immediate danger. Standing by was a chain of ships, like a song. These are the names of the ships: U.S. Lighthouse Tender Cedar, USS Peterson, King and Wing, Estabeth, Anita Phillips, Amy, Excursion, Eleanor, Elsinore, Lone Fisherman. These were the small ships that went out. Most of them were Libby McNeil and Libby vessels at the time the cannery was operating here, as you probably know. And these were the ships that went out, and they didn't go out once. They didn't ask once. They kept going out and asking, "Can we be of any help? Can we take the passengers off?" And of course, the storm didn't just constantly hit. There were times when it would have been possible, but very dangerous to get anybody off the ship to the smaller vessels down below. But it could have been, it was an option.
It seems like there are a lot of factors that were going into those choices.
Yes, you know, and no one knows, you know, what the captain told the passengers, why the passengers seemed calm. He assured them that this was something, that they were safe, that they were, there wasn't a problem. I'm sure he must have. I mean, what happened on the ship? Nobody will ever know, because no one survived it.
Well, but people wrote very poignant letters,
yes,
which survived. And if anyone is interested in this, there's a book, The Sinking of the Princess Sophia, Taking the North Down with Her, by Ken Coates and Bill Morrison. And now there's a new book called Stranded, Alaska's Worst Maritime Disaster Nearly Happened Twice, which compares the Princess Sophia with the grounding of the Star Princess on Poundstone Rock. Which didn't cause any deaths, but...
Okay. Will you remind us again about Friday and how it...
Yes. On board was Walter Harper and his bride, Frances Wells. And and Walter Harper was the first person, young man as he was, with Hudson Stuck's expedition to the top of Mount McKinley. Now
the first to summit McKinley. A lot of people don't know we have in our cemetery that person, Walter Harper.
And he was at Athabascan and Irish by heritage. And he was Hudson Stuck, the Archdeacon Hudson Stuck's protege. And so he was, you know, he's one of a kind. And the gathering at the grave, which is short and sweet because in October you really don't want to be outside very long, especially if it's raining sideways. So the Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, of which Walter Harper was an Episcopalian and with Archdeacon Stuck, honors that commemorative date and gathers just to remember. And recently I have been made aware that I always thought that there was only that couple that was buried at Evergreen, but there isn't. There are 21 people buried there, including Harper and Wells.
They're doing a mapping of the cemetery.
And where will this ceremony begin? What region of the cemetery?
Well, at the
grave. On the uphill side.
On the uphill side, closer to the uphill entrance. But parking is limited, so the parking is a little better on the lower side off of Glacier, as you probably know.
Okay, and you said noon you're going to gather?
Yes, it'll be at noon, and there'll be just a little remembrance. And we're looking forward to Father Emeritus Mark Besser being there and Father Wilson Valentine from the Episcopal Church. And we just look forward to invite anyone who is interested and curious to join us. Just won't take long. Little chunk out of your noon hour, and come by and just remember that particular sad moment. But we'd still like to remember the people that stayed here.
Okay. That's the voice of Mary Lou Spartz and Kathy Ruddy as well. Thank you both for coming into the studio. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you, Scott. Well, I would just like to add that we're looking forward to the commemorative year in 2018. And the Pioneers of Alaska are working hard on projects. And we have, I'm working very hard on some ideas of my own, and I invite anyone who was very interested to join me, always strength the numbers, to give me a call. My number is 780-4340, or Kathy, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd love to have you and your enthusiasm and your ideas to join us for that particular commemoration.
Okay. Mary Lou and Kathy, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Scott.
I will love you forever, my darling. My lover, Mrs. Harper, my one. And the north wind is starting to blow in. Hold tightly, my darling, hold tight.
Captain seems cities they are building tonight, and the princess fires are foundering. I'm afraid not a soul will survive. There's a hollow on the shores near Tea Harbor from the dog who just barely survived, and he cries for the Princess Sophia. Goodbye, my Sophia.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center. Now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Fall schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/diamond park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host, is about 33 minutes after the hour. I've been joined in the studio now by Jessie Post. She is the UAS Alumni Relations Manager. Welcome, Jessie.
Thanks, Scott.
And also Deb Reidman. She's the Career Services Advisor at UAS. Welcome to the show, Deb.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
Okay. So this Thursday, very interesting, there's going to be a career and networking panel here in the building. So 5:30 at 360. What was the inspiration for this, Jessie?
Well, this is kind of a new event that we're putting on in partnership with Deb and Career Services at UAS, and also with Katie Jordan from the School of Management. And the reasoning behind putting on this event is we definitely would like to collaborate more in the future, but we there's a lot of research that shows that young alums and students that are about to graduate are really seeking wider professional networks and a lot of these career resources that they get when they are students at UAS, which Deb helps them with on a daily basis.
Okay. And what can one expect on Thursday night, Deb? What's it going to look like down there?
Well, we're really excited about this. We're going to have a wide range of professionals that represent many different areas. So, for example, we're very fortunate to have Pam Day, who is the HR consultant for the Department of Administration, the state of Alaska, and Laura Ashe, Director of Communications and Administration for the Permanent Fund Corporation, Peter Jones from NOAA, Julie Staveland, she's a planner for the Department of Transportation, and then we're still waiting for word back from LG Rayfield and Mertz. So just a wide range of professionals who will be able to give our audience, our students, our alumni, and whoever from the community attends, just a perspective regarding topics that our students are curious about. So we're thrilled that they're giving up of their time to share with us, and we're really excited to hear what they have to say.
And, you know, you two talk to students a lot, I'm sure. What is the job climate these days like for them?
It's actually very good. So I can tell you here in the state of Alaska, there's jobs. There's plentiful jobs, especially here in Juneau. I know with the state cutting its budget in several different areas, but at the same time, I get phone calls on a weekly basis from employers that are looking for potential candidates. And so part of our challenge is to be able to connect students with the type of jobs that they're interested in, the type of industries and businesses that they want to invest in and grow with, and then, you know, broker those relationships, those connections, so that students can get started in an area where there is a need, and they can continue with their professional development. So
I remember back in my day, networking was this big word. Is it still an important part of finding a job?
Yeah, I think it's probably still one of the most important pieces is, expanding those that you know, and especially professionals, and getting your name out there, making a contact, you know, not making sure you have that personal touch. You meet people in person, and that still carries a lot of weight today, I think, even as it did, you know, years back.
Yeah, and with social networking and all of that and digital presence, how are things changing, would you say?
Well, I think one tool that has been exceptionally effective is LinkedIn. And so we're going to be encouraging our students to create LinkedIn profiles so that they can be connected with alumni as well as professionals within the field of interest. And that could produce some mentorships, some internships. And so being able to connect through a vehicle like LinkedIn is great. But what's really wonderful about this state is the degree of separation is practically one. So students can get to those decision makers from those people in higher levels where they can connect within a department and be able to maybe get started on an internship or an entry-level position. So networking, in fact, 80% of jobs that are secured is through networking, knowing somebody who knows somebody. And so this event is another great opportunity for our students, our alumni, and our community members to be able to connect with people within the business arena and ask those kinds of questions, develop those relationships, those professional relationships where they can take it to the next step if it leads that way.
How would you describe who would benefit most from going to Thursday night's event?
Yeah, well, obviously we've invited students, we've invited our alumni association members, but I mean, really the target audience is for recent alumni and students who are about to graduate, or even people who are looking to change their careers and go on a new career path. The skills that we will cover are useful, I think, for anyone at any level, at any position in their professional life. But, I mean, really the target is, like we said, for people that are kind of newer to the workforce, but there will definitely be some topics that will touch on everything for anyone.
Okay. Is there a cost?
Yeah. Well, it's free for students and for alumni association members, but there is a $10 fee for community members, and there will also be appetizers and a no-host bar, so it's to kind of help cover some of those costs.
Okay, so this is this Thursday at 360 here in the K2 building from 5:30 to 7. What else should we tell folks about?
Well, one thing that we're offering people as well is the ability to join us remotely. Our campus, the University of Alaska Southeast, a lot of our students are distance students, and so we have developed that connection with students on a remote basis. And so we're going to have a link that's going to be provided with 360 North, so that they can connect via online and be able to ask questions. And in fact, If they do ask some questions, they'll be entered into a drawing for a $50 gift card. So we highly encourage people to participate remotely from the comfort of their own home. And we've got questions already that students have submitted. So people, as they start thinking about what do they really want to know from people that are going to be on the panel, and then they'll be able to have a chance to ask those questions during this event.
Sounds good. Jesse, anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just like to say that the link for that, if you do want to go online, is www.360north.org/UAS-career-networking. It's a long one, but that's the site you'll need to visit to watch the event online.
Great. Jesse Post, Deb Reibman, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We'll see you on Thursday night.
Great. Thank you, Scott.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 20th of October, 2015. It's the birthday of the poet Arthur Rimbaud, born in Charleville, France, in 1854, who had odd habits of taking off his clothes and shouting obscenities in public, which tended to put people off, but everyone agreed that he was a genius as a poet. Started publishing when he was 16, and when he was 19, he gave it up and took off to wander around the world. Wrote letters to his family, but never wrote another poem. It's the birthday of the satirist Art Buchwald, born Mount Vernon, New York, 1925. Art Buchwald, who said, "If you attack the establishment long enough and hard enough, they will make you a member of it." It's the birthday of the poet Robert Pinsky, Long Branch, New Jersey, 1940. Parents wanted him to be an optician, but he chose to go to college, the first one in his family to do so. Robert Pinsky, who said, "I think that if an audience for any art is having a good time, they are willing to suspend the need for comprehension for a while. That's part of the pleasure. And if it doesn't sound good, it is boring, even if we understand it." That's the trouble with a lot of boring art. You understand the stupid cop show or the tedious sitcom gag too soon and too completely. Same for the stupid middlebrow poem. It's the birthday of the man who designed St. Paul's Cathedral in London, Christopher Wren, the architect, born in East Noyle, England, 1632. He also knew about medicine and mechanics. He was a brilliant mathematician and astronomer and a philosopher. And he had very good manners, Christopher Wren, and he especially disliked swearing. When he was overseeing the construction of St. Paul's, he issued an edict that any laborer who was heard taking the Lord's name in vain would be dismissed from the job. Here's a poem for today by Carrie Fountain entitled "Want." The wasps outside the kitchen window are making that thick, unraveling sound again, floating in and out of the bald head of their nest, seeming not to move while moving, and it has just occurred to me, standing, washing the coffee pot, watching them hang loosely in the air, thin wings, thick, elongated abdomens, sad, down-pointing antennae, that this is the heart's constant project, this simple learning how to hold hopelessness and hope together, to see on the unharmed surface of one the great scar of the other, to recognize both and to make something of both, to desire everything and nothing at once, and to desire it all the time, and to contain that desire fleshly in a body, to wash it and rest it and feed it, to learn its name and from whence it came, and to speak to it, most of all, to speak to it every day, saying to one part, "Well, maybe this is all you get," while saying to the other, "Go on, break it open, let it go." Want, a poem by Carrie Fountain from her collection Burn Lake, published by Penguin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. Produced by Joy Biles with Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement, available at various locations in Southeast.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on October 20th, 2015. It's about 15 minutes till the top of the hour. We have a few extra minutes on the show today, so here is a Mudrooms performance from September by Joe Nelson.
Joe Nelson graduated from Yakutat High School in 1988, UCLA in 1996 and 1998. This must be a typo. So he graduated from Yakutat High School in 1988. No. That's not funny, but UCLA in 1996 and 1998 and Loyola Law School in 2001. He has worked at the University of Alaska Southeast and served on the Sea Alaska and Yakutat Quam boards of directors for more than a decade. He lives in downtown Juneau with his wife and three kids. He's a lifelong Democrat, although he did not vote for Dukakis in 1988. And he learned how to spell Murkowski in 2010. Please welcome Joe Nelson.
Thank you, Amanda. So, the one that got away, just by a show of hands, who was in Juneau, living in Juneau in 2009, in the room here? So, the story and the invite, I had a prompt that was given to me even ahead of time as a thought to tell the story. And for those of you that were here, this story, and the reason I got pulled up here, is something that some of you, most of you, probably had some familiarity with. It was above the fold news for about 2 days in 2009. How many people still read a paper that folds? We're going to start losing what that means pretty soon here. But it was above the fold for a couple days in 2009. We had a senator who left Juneau to go work in D.C. for the Obama administration. And that's why the introduction had the comments about being a Democrat. An opening happened. And for those of you just to recall, and those that weren't here, just process-wise, when there is an opening, the governor, the job of the governor, when there's a vacancy midterm, the governor is supposed to appoint somebody to fill that seat from that district from the same party. Simple enough. It happens as a matter of course every now and then, and it shouldn't be that big of a deal. But here's the rub. 2009, downtown Democrat, our broad Democrat seat here with our then governor, 2009. Sarah Palin, still in the news. So it is a comedy that you can imagine. With the Republican Governor Palin needing to appoint a Democrat to fill a seat here in Juneau, and folks who are around kind of witnessed the quite an interesting time that we're still living with, unfortunately, today, in the media and social media and other things. So as I wrestled with this story, and I knew there might be some interest to tell this story downtown Juneau, but so much of it is I guess fairly mundane and not pretty politics, and I thought of all the little quirks along the way. I was going through what felt like literally at the time a circus of this appointment process, because I did, my name got pulled into the pool there. So I had the little interview with Governor Palin. Name got put forward. Then it's up to 9 Senate Democrats to vote on it. They'd already kicked out the guy before. He didn't make it. I'm in round 2. Got quickly kicked out, chewed up and kicked out the door. The Democrats and our governor were not agreeing on something. Surprise, surprise. And as I thought about the story there and sort of the politics there, and some of the funny things to me were largely about the media kind of looking with kind of scary grins on them, chasing me around, looking for some magical strings with Sarah Palin pulling these strings behind me, trying to figure this mystery out of why me? Why is this guy here? Why him? I thought more of the real story really is, that was the story that I should tell a little more about. Why me? Why this Native kid from the village with a lot of diplomas on the wall? One did come in 96, one did come in 98. That's called an undergraduate degree and a master's degree. And then a law degree. And then passed the bar and practiced law for a little while in Juneau here. And really see that there's bigger fish to fry. There's plenty of attorneys in this town. And as I looked at the docket on the criminal records weekly, I just couldn't do that type of work, make a living out of it. It just wasn't fulfilling. I quickly and easily got recruited to work at the university. And as I thought about this story, I thought of the ones that got away, and why I'm here really goes back to that community of Yakutat. And that whole community for my entire life expected me to do big things. And it's largely because of 3 men who died before I was 7. So for me, those were the 3 men that got away. My father was a successful businessman, hunter, and Yakutat and community leader. My namesake, my Uncle Joe, he was known as the funniest guy in town and the toughest guy in town at the same time. Yeah, he passed away when I was a kid. And then Kahaku, my Tlingit name, came from our last traditional brown bear takeaway chief in Yakutat. And he gave that to me right before he passed away. And they all died before I was young. So for me, those gentlemen, everybody in the community related to me since I was that tall through one of those giants and expected me to do big things because those men all did these big things and I inherited a big legacy and still been struggling to live up to it today. So that's what, for me, those are the ones that got away. And as I think of the life I lived, you know, the other part that got away was I lived in L.A. for a lot of years. I left the little village Yakutat. I passed up, you know, Stanford, Dartmouth, and Berkeley because L.A. has sandy beaches and 70-plus degree weather with everything that comes with it that any other 18-year-old young man would say that's a no-brainer. And along the way, I collected all those degrees. So that corporate life, living, being an attorney in L.A., that got away. Being a beach bum got away. But the other thing that got away was the village life in Yakutat. Just living off the land and living a more real, holistic life there. And it's because of this curse of all these degrees I collected along the way that I ended up being stuck here in this town. But last show of hands for anybody who has a young person who they know that grew up in this community or in the state and is now living in the 48 just with huge potential that grew up here and moved out of state, this brain drain. And if you think of that person's name and those people, those are the ones that got away. In my mind, and that's why I'm settled here working at the university, to reel those folks back, bring our talent back, and hopefully encourage them all to vote, encourage them all to be engaged. So I thank you for the invite tonight, and I appreciate the efforts of everybody here, and I appreciate the cause. So that's why I accepted this invite, was largely the mission and the goodwill in this community and where the money's going. Thank you.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. It's about 6 minutes to the top of the hour. We just heard a Mudrooms presentation from Joe Nelson. That was recorded in September of this year. The next Mudrooms will be on November 10th at 7 p.m. And the title is Shenanigans. You can find more information about Mudrooms at mudrooms.org. On a Juno Afternoon, I'll be your host again. Annie Bartholomew will be here to highlight this Friday's Zombie Walk. We'll discuss Thursday's community discussion on racism, retribution, and religion. And Richard Paisley and Jim Clark will be here with a preview of this weekend's Juno World Affairs Council Forum on Water. Those interviews, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more on KTOO News Juno. If you missed the live show, it's also available at 4 p.m. on KRNN and online at ktoo.org. It's currently 45 degrees at the Juneau Airport, 43 in Gustavus, 46 in Hoonah. Let's take a look at the forecast here. Tonight, rain, lows around 43. Tomorrow, calls for rain, highs around 49. On Thursday, showers, highs around 47. Friday, calls for rain, showers likely, highs around 45. And Saturday, and Saturday night, mostly cloudy. Highs 43 to 48. Thanks for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same place.